Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network weekly lecture series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
This is the WGBH Forum Network.
I'm going to just take a couple minutes of your time before we turn things over to our fantastic panel that we have up behind me, and answer a couple of questions, basic questions. The first one is, why landscape and music? Why are we doing this program? And a related one is, what does the legacy of Frederick Law Olmsted, our nation's foremost park designer and the man regarded as the founder of landscape architecture in the United States, how does that relate to music, as Olmsted is not known as a musician, among other things, and how do we come to mix these two genres, these two different art forms together in a single program? And a good way to answer these two questions is to go directly to the writings of Frederick Law Olmsted. And in fact, I'm going to recite a quote from Notes on the Plan of Franklin Park, which he wrote in 1886 while developing the plan for this particular Emerald Necklace landscape that's also in your program. And he referred to a naturalistic park landscape of the sort that he believed deeply in as creating, quote, an effect on the human organism by an action of what it presents to view, which action, like that of music, is of a kind that goes back of thought and cannot be fully given the form of words, unquote. And essentially, Olmsted is comparing the effect of experiencing landscape on the human psyche to that of music, and saying that both of those experiences are essentially nonverbal forms of communication to us. And they're forms of communication that affect us beyond conscious thought, that they somehow affect us subconsciously and in a profound way. And Olmsted, who was someone who believed very strongly that the passive experience of what he would refer to as pleasing rural scenery, he uses that term also in the Notes on the Plan of Franklin Park, said the following, and I think it's useful in looking at the role of music in landscape. He said, first, a man's eyes cannot be as much occupied as they are in large cities by artificial things or by natural things seen under obviously artificial conditions without a harmful effect first on his mental and nervous system and ultimately on his entire constitutional organization. And he continues by saying that relief from this evil is to be obtained through recreation, is often said without sufficient discrimination as to the nature of the recreation required. The several varieties of recreation to be obtained in churches, newspapers, theaters, picture galleries, billiard rooms, baseball grounds, trotting courses, and flower gardens may each serve to supply a mitigating influence. An influence is desirable, however, that acting through the eye shall be more than mitigative, that shall be antithetical, reversive, and antidotal. Such an influence is to be found in what will be called the enjoyment of pleasing rural scenery. So Olmsted essentially believed that the most powerful tool for reversing the stress, the anonymity and the harshness of the artificial urban constructed environment was the passive experience of nature as constructed, as designed in a park of the sort that he would create. And that this was a more powerful effect than things like going to a baseball game, going to a movie, going to church. So, in fact, going to Franklin Park may be on a higher pinnacle than going to see the Red Sox at Fenway Park, if that's not heresy to say. And it raises the question, given his other quote, is as to whether music is on a higher plane than churches, newspapers, and theaters, and somehow is roughly comparable to the direct experience of landscape. And it's a question that I perhaps pose generally to the panel to maybe consider, and to you in the audience to consider as well. Now, we have a truly outstanding panel this evening that consists of Scott Alaric, who will moderate tonight, Charles Anspacher, Rand Blake, Mark Arely, and Anya Minogue. And they will explore, among other things, the different ways in which landscape can influence music, whether as a creative inspiration for music, as sort of a muse to those people who compose music, to being a theme in music, to being a venue for performance, you know, in that outdoor performances can be a very special experience, and music as a way of educating the public and connecting the public in a more profound way to the environment. And certainly the events of yesterday with the Live Earth performances around the world, you know, emphasize the role that music can play in that way. So to guide us through both the discussion and performance tonight is Scott Alaric, who is the principal folk music writer for the Boston Globe and has had that role for about 20 years. A folk singer and songwriter, he has a 2006 album out, All That Is True, Folk Songs Old and New. He is the author of Deep Community, Adventures in the Modern Folk Music Underground. And as I like to say, he is sort of an informal scholar of the form of folk music. And it's my pleasure to turn things over to Scott Alaric.
Thank you, Mark. Informal scholar, I like that. Expert without portfolio. I know what some of you must be thinking right now, leading off the program. Oh, a singing critic. How special. One of the real privileges, pleasures for me of getting involved in this project has been getting to know Frederick Law Olmsted a little better through his writings and the way he thought. And I've been struck, really, by how much like a musician he thought, in that he saw landscapes as being full not only of natural beauty but of emotional movement. And if you've ever walked around any part of the Emerald Necklace, you know that the moods change a lot. You know, you'll be in a place where you're sort of led toward watching nature, you know, like looking at the ducks in the pond or looking at a lot of natural activity. Other places where you'll be very secluded and very alone and you can't really even see that you're in a city. You just seem to be in some sort of woodsy glen. And other places where you're sort of led to look at other people, to watch other people enjoying nature. And he did that very deliberately. He was really looking. He would walk around in the natural world and in remote landscapes, and you know he would look into the Grand Canyon and he would ask himself, "How is this making me feel? And why is it making me feel this way? And how could I give somebody this feeling in the middle of a big city, so that they don't lose touch with that important part of who they are?" And I think that's very much how a lot of brilliant musicians think in terms of, you know, how can I take this way I'm feeling now and translate this into music in a way that perhaps I could transfer it to somebody else. I thought I would start sort of at the beginning of the music trail with some traditional songs that were written by anonymous singers long, long ago, and show some of the ways that traditional musicians use nature as a palette and the power of it. This first song it's an early American folk song. It's got as most American folk songs, it's got its roots in Europe. There's a couple of Irish songs that bear a resemblance to this, but I think the way it was transformed sometime in colonial America, it became a very uniquely American song. And think about in the context of this program and landscape and music, how the singer uses nature, because he's telling a very human story, but he uses a natural image to set a real emotional bed, to invite us in, to let us know how he's feeling before he starts to tell the story. Or you can just forget all of that and lean back and listen. It's called Pretty Sarah. the wild birds all whistle, their sounds do increase. Farewell, pretty sparrow, I must bid you adieu, and I'll dream of pretty sparrow. First of all, that has got, I think, got to be in the top 10 list anyway of the saddest lines in any love song. My love, she won't have me, and I understand. But I love the way that long ago singer who sort of, you know, tugs at your heartstrings by saying, you know, he's too illiterate to let us know how he feels. You know, if only I could write a letter and explain everything about how I feel after he has so brilliantly brought us into this lonesome place using a natural description that all of us can relate to. I mean, why does he take us to a lone hollow before? It has nothing to do with the story he's telling. And then later, when he wants to explain how he's feeling now, he moves us to a river so that it's still a lonesome place, but the waters are overflowing. You know, it's a little more turbulent to show the kind of the roiling feelings that are in him along with the sadness. And it's a great use of impressionism, of trying to create an emotional moment, you know, probably 200 years before the French think they invented the idea. And I wanted to sing, now this is an American cowboy song. Singer, I think, some old unnamed cowboy from back in the 1870s, he does exactly the opposite, I think, and I really didn't think this about this until I was getting ready for the show, and I realized he really does exactly the opposite. In this one, he begins with a very human story, a very simple human story about a girl that he likes. He doesn't tell us what his relationship with her is, who she is, or where she's gone, just that he's not with her. And I think he uses the human story here the way the author of Pretty Sarah used the natural landscape, you know, the way he uses the natural landscape to set up the emotional bed to tell this human, very human story that has nothing to do with the natural landscape in it. In this, I think the song is very much about the landscape. It's about being in a big open place like a prairie on a cattle drive and feeling that sense of that combination of loneliness and longing. So he tells us this little human story, but he doesn't give us enough details to make it about the human story. He makes it clear that that's just the hook to get us into seeing this life on the prairie that he's living and to feel what this emotional moment feels like for him. It's called Colorado Trail. I always loved this song. When I was in my 20s, I kept trying to learn it, and I couldn't because it drove me crazy that he doesn't say what happened, that he doesn't tell the whole story. And it wasn't until I was much older that I realized that that's the brilliance of it, that he, by leaving certain things out, he compels us to look at what the song is really about, which is just this feeling, this emotional moment that he wants to capture and does so well. Called Colorado Trail. Eyes like a morning star, cheeks like a rose. Laura was a pretty girl, everybody knows. We'd all eat falling grapes, well winds wet, all along, along, along the Colorado Trail.
Thank you.
Oh, I like that song, but you could probably tell that. Another thing that landscape in traditional music does so well, and I think has influenced poets ever since, poets and writers ever since, is you notice in those two songs, there's nothing obscure about the natural images. They're looking for things that are very common to all of us, things that even if we've never been on a cattle drive, the pictures that that old cowboy painted are very easy for us to see and imagine, not just the physical, but the emotional. And what I think one of the great powers of folk verse, folk lyrics is they use that kind of universal metaphoric language, poetic language, which kicks in our memory. I think it's something that some modern writers forget, you know, when they describe something and they want you to see exactly what they see, where the traditional poets wanted you to see just enough so that you'd fill the rest in from your own memory. And once you are remembering a song at the same moment you're listening to it, it goes deep inside you into a place where your emotions are, and it becomes your song, your cattle drive, your lone hollow. Well, moving along here. Got this great panel. And now the way it's going to work is everybody's going to do about 10 minutes or so, and then we'll take an intermission. Then everybody's going to do a little shorter selection in the second half, and then we'll throw it open to questions for all of you. I'm really proud to introduce Rand Blake, who is someone who has been a brilliant performing musician for years and years and has done so much more than just play music to help the music along. A real towering figure in the Boston music scene, and I think the music scene all over the world. He was a rising young jazz musician when he met Gunther Schuller in 1959. With Schuller, he helped pioneer and develop what's become known as the third stream way of teaching music. That combines conventional Western techniques with ear training and improvisation. And the first, and I don't know if it's still the only, third stream department was formed at the New England Conservatory, and he still is the chair of that department. He's advocated what he calls the primacy of the ear in music training, suggesting that when all the emphasis is on sight reading and using your eyes to read and to learn music, that we're not playing to our strongest sense when it comes to music. But he's also, as you'll hear in just a moment, a brilliant jazz pianist and has recorded dozens of albums, more than 30 solo piano albums since 1965. And I think also, as you'll see, music is a profoundly visual experience. For Rand, and he's often inspired by landscapes, both in his own physical environment and in visual from visual media like film. In fact, he described his earliest music style as coming from a musical immersion in what he called a film noir world. Rand wanted to get right to the playing, so he asked me to explain a little of some of the pieces he's going to perform. The first piece Rand's going to do is called Forest Walk, and it concerns a wonderful path at 11 Chestnut Place. This property belonged to the late Dorothy Wallace, who had made Brookline her home since the late 30s. She was quite a legend in local music circles, and some felt she was the avant-garde Isabella Gardner. She presented many musical evenings at her home, and the repertoire would range from Verdi to Ornette Coleman to Greek folk music to Cole Porter. But as well as being a musical patron and a patron of wonderful painters, she was a great appreciator of landscape architecture. Friends of Dorothy Wallace have had a row of shadow trees. Is that shadow trees planted at the public gardens along the edge closest to the Four Seasons Hotel? She engaged Harry Davis to look over her trees, shrubs, and fabulous gardens. Eileen Murphy, beloved friend and archivist, has the following words to say about the forest path that inspired Rand's first selection. For the many days and nights, for the cork trees, the multitudes of flowers, the towering oaks, moonlight in the hollow, especially in ice and fresh snow, for the healing waters of the pool, the quiet, shady places to sit and reflect. And that'll be Rand's first piece. His second piece is called High on a Windy Hill, and was recorded by American pop and cabaret legend Chris Connor, a delightful, immaculate singer. In June of 1956, it is dedicated to nature and to Ms. Connor, who is celebrating her 80th birthday this year, and there will be a public evening celebrating that August 14th at Brown Hall at the New England Conservatory at 6:30. The third piece is called Midnight in Central Park, and it concerns Central Park, obviously, but only appreciates the special genius of Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed Central Park indirectly. It was inspired by a scene from the classic horror film Cat People. Any of you seen Cat People? It's a great movie, and it's a visually haunting movie produced by Val Lewton, directed by Jacques Tournier, cinematography by Nicholas Muzureka? I'm saying this like I know what I'm talking about, don't I? A young woman is being followed late at night by a person called Irina, who might be related to a cat. Rand described himself here as a would-be film director, and we see the trip from west to east. Cat People is the name of a Halloween production of the Third Stream Contemporary Improvisation Department at New England Conservatory, and we will continue the noir direction Halloween Eve 2007 with Spiral Staircases. So here is Rand Blake. Áine Minogue was born in County Tipperary, Ireland, part of a large musical family. She fell in love with a Celtic harp at age 12 and cut her teeth professionally performing at the legendary Bunratty Castle in County Clare. Over the years, and I think especially since moving here, right, she's immersed herself very deeply in study of ancient Celtic lore and music and the connection between Irish music and ancient Celtic spirituality, particularly the way real people used music not only to worship but to make their day-to-day lives more spiritual and meaningful. Of course, landscape was terribly important to the ancient Celts. They believed the gods were in everything that lived, trees, ground, sky, water, wildlife, and in themselves as well. Áine has recorded 8 albums of Celtic harp music, many of them focusing on particular areas of life and how ancient people used music to experience them and enrich them, including what I think is just a brilliant and generous and important album called Celtic Lamentations, which traces the music used in the process of grief and mourning and showed how different music, either ceremonial or just informal music, was used to move people through the various stages of grief and loss. And she also recorded To Warm the Winter's Night about the rituals of midwinter, the ancient Celtic and Irish rituals of midwinter, many of them predating the Christian celebration of Christmas, and showing how that season, how people used music to deal with that season, which of course still haunts us as the coldest and darkest time of the year. We can only long for it on a night like tonight. And to do a few pieces for us here, please welcome the wonderful Áine Minogue.
Thank you so much. They made me follow you. I'm going to play a couple of tunes for you, maybe sing you a song. And the one thing I would love to point out is that for the Celts, the landscape was inseparable from the time of year. And I'm going to start with a piece. It's called The Butterfly. And for me, it evokes the springtime and sort of all the madness of the springtime. And I hope you like it. Thank you.
Reflect the actual mood of the landscape. Most of the tunes in Irish music are just named after the landscape, like the stack of barley. And I suppose the great difference between Olmsted and his relationship to landscape was that it was architectural. For the Celts, it was strictly natural. And as Scott said, the divine was present in everything. Whereas we might say, I think, therefore I am. They said, nature is, the sea is, the trees is. Trees are, therefore I am. Their relationship to themselves as human beings was very much in relationship to the natural world. It was also in relation to the not-so-natural world and the idea of landscape as a gateway to the other world, in that nothing was just as it seemed. And there were basically three types of other worlds. One was a type of heaven, Chirnanog, the land of eternal youth. One of the other ones was the land beneath the ground, sort of the world of fairy, which was much different from our Disney idea of fairy. And the third land was the land beneath the waves, so that the sea wasn't just the sea. There was a whole world of existence and mythology that went on under those waves. I'm sure you've heard of the magic of the seventh wave. One of the great sort of folklore stories that comes from the sea are the stories of Selkies, which were seals that would come on land and live as human beings. And these stories were often used as sort of psychological tools for people for symbolic thinking. At a time when people didn't have psychologists and therapists, I guess there's a high percentage here in Brookline. So, just kidding. And so at that, for those times, the tools that people often use were taken from mythology, particularly if the tools they needed, if they couldn't find the answers within their various religions. So this is a piece called The Selkie, which is about a woman who's had a child by one of these seal beings, and she understands that one day she must return her child to the sea.
Land that he stopped seeing. you very much.
You can really feel the motion of the ocean in that melody, can't you? And the darkness of it. I don't need these. I just thought it might help me look distinguished. Really just need them to see. It's hard to imagine a more perfect guest for this program than Charles Ansbacher. He's conducted orchestras all over the world, including the Moscow Symphony, the Vienna Chamber Orchestra, the Innsbruck Philharmonic, and the Colorado Springs Orchestra, which he helped develop and with whom he was named Conductor Laureate. He is especially focused, very important work on conducting music, bringing music to troubled regions, to what they kind of, I think, rather flippantly call hot spots around the world, such as Azerbaijan, Belarus, and Sarajevo, and Belgrade, where he was the first American to appear on stage after the NATO-led bombing of Serbia during the Kosovo crisis. But what makes him so ideal for this particular program is his important and delightful work in creating and conducting the Boston Landmarks Orchestra, which specializes in taking great orchestral music into Boston's most beautiful and historic areas. Charles told me that one of the taglines the Landmark Orchestra believes in is the synergy between sight, S-I-T-E, and sound. An added benefit by having great music displayed at great landmarks is giving audiences a chance to see how each augments the other, creating a more impactful moment for both the enjoyment of the music and the enjoyment of the landscape. You can sort of maybe imagine what it would be like to be on some gray, rocky coastline looking out at the ocean while you were listening to Onya sing the great Silky of Sulskari. And I think when I talked to Charles a little earlier, I thought the way he talked about bringing music to beautiful sights was very similar to the way Olmsted felt about how he wanted to recreate these sites. And the way he would visit, as I said before, the way Olmsted would visit places that were known for their beauty and ask himself, and we can only imagine composers who use landscape like Beethoven doing the same thing, asking not just, you know, why is this beautiful, but how is it making me feel? Why is this location having this effect on me? And how can I translate that and bring that to people so that they can be filled with it in their own lives in various creative ways? Olmsted through designing things like the Emerald Necklace, and Beethoven through much of the great music that he wrote. And Charles is, there are going to be some recorded examples, and he's going to sort of explain where the landscape is in these great pieces. Charles Ansbacher.
Thank you. I guess that I am the representative on this panel who has a particularly interest in music that we call classical. And that music has a long tradition of being interested in the natural world. And the classical music, as we know it, really began in the Baroque era. And as we think about that, perhaps the most familiar of all of those works or composers is Vivaldi. And of his some 650 works, the single most enjoyed today is his Seasons. And in this particular piece, he describes four of the seasons of the year. And in each, he creates through the solo violin an effect that maybe in the wintertime evokes the snow or the howling winds, and the others, the seasons are represented as well. The idea that classical music is somehow devoid from nature, of course, would be all wrong. There's been a long history of composers who were inspired by the natural settings. The Landmarks Orchestra that Scott mentioned that I founded in 2001, we were about the idea of performing familiar classical works in landmark settings. And Boston has so many historic landmark settings, it was an easy connection to make. And what Olmsted helped create for Boston, plus the other historic settings in our city, make music I think it's an easy way to bridge music and the natural settings through either historic or architectural or landscapes that were created by Olmsted. The music that I would first like to talk about is that of Beethoven. He loved nature and enjoyed...
Excuse me, just one more short. Are you hearing that okay? The mic doesn't seem to be quite as alive as some of the others. Can you hear okay? Good.
Beethoven, who lived outside of the city of Vienna in Heiligenstadt, which was at the time really a very country environment, he loved going for walks. And he enjoyed hearing the natural sounds of the bubbling brook or the wind rustling in the trees or the birds. And oddly, as he got older, he would go for walks and he would hear none of those sounds. The sounds were there, but he was becoming deaf and was unable to actually hear that. He found it peculiar that the birds had stopped singing and that the brook had stopped gurgling, but he had it in his mind, and still he was able to incorporate some of those sounds in his works, and particularly those works which were programmatic in nature, that were specifically telling a story or describing a situation. His Symphony No. 6, which has the nickname the Pastorale, I'm going to use as perhaps the most obvious example of this. And in the second movement, which is entitled By the Brook, it starts with a meter, a 12/8 meter, which I think sounds a little bit, anyway, to me, like the passing of water in a brook. And soon after you get this swaying sound, dee-dum-bum-ba-dum-bum-bee-dum-bum-ba-dum-bum, soon after you hear that several times, you begin to hear what perhaps are birds, and then these birds gradually sing, and then that leads into a gorgeous melody, which is perhaps his thoughts as he's walking along apart from the natural settings. So I'm going to ask if we can hear the beginning of the second movement of the Beethoven Sixth Symphony. Towards the end of the second movement, of this symphony, there is another example which is more literal in its imitation of bird sounds. And here he uses the flute that imitates the sound of a nightingale. Then he uses the oboe to imitate the sound of a quail, and then a clarinet to imitate the cuckoo. It happens twice. I might mention this is actually a recording of a performance of the Moscow Symphony in February of this year that I had the good fortune of conducting at the Great Hall of the Conservatory in Moscow. So the end of the second movement of the Beethoven. Before I play the last musical example, I'd like to just travel a bit through musical history and say that Beethoven, who started the Romantic era in music, really the style that was so prevalent in the 19th century, that there were many other composers in this time, like Smetana, who came later, who wrote an entire piece about his homeland and specifically one section about the Moldau River, which traces the flow of the river through, specifically through the countryside in different locations. And you can hear as it comes through different parts of the what is now the Czech Republic. That's some example of nature, landscape in classical music.
Our final guest here, Mark Arely, is one of the best and brightest songwriters on the New England scene today. But his own career keeps getting interrupted because he's also one of the best and most versatile folk musicians in New England. And he just finished, for example, a world tour as an accompanist for Laurie McKenna, the Stoughton songwriting star, on the huge Faith Hill Tim McGraw tour. Which is, I think, the most successful country music tour in history. That's what they're saying. I'm sure Mark would be the first to give some of the credit for that to Faith and Tim. he hails from Western Massachusetts, and the lovely and very diverse landscape out there is very much a character in his songs, comes up in a lot of different ways. He not only writes specifically about nature, but uses landscape in ways to make his very human and often very modern points in his songs. When I chatted with him about all this, he said, at first the idea of a program exploring music and landscape seemed crazy to me. He said, it's like the difference between context and experience. To me, they're inseparable. In this kind of music, landscape is where everything starts. It's how you set the scene. How do you pull them apart enough to analyze them? Landscape is always there. It's not in the corner of the room. It is the room. Mark Arely.
This particular landscape is kind of blowing my mind right now because my dad taught at this high school for 30 years. And I remember coming to his classroom as a boy, young boy. I don't know how that was legal, but he brought me in here. So it's nice to be back. Trouble come falling from a pure blue sky. Went down to the well, but the well was dry. Wasn't nothing but a bucket and a hole in the ground. So I pitched myself like a penny thrown, but my wits just echoed off a cold gray stone. Wasn't even enough water left to drown. I'm too weary to believe a change is gonna come. Shelter me or leave me here to wither in the sun undone. Well, I tried to give more than I took. I heard the word and I read the book. And I listened close for to hear my Savior call. And as the lightning flashed and the thunder broke, I couldn't help but wonder, did I miss the joke? Did you prop me up just to watch me fall? I'm too weary to believe a change is gonna come. Shelter me or leave me here to wither in the sun. Thank you very much. Well, Scott, actually, when we were talking before the panel, just discussing kind of various approaches we could take, Scott had brought that last song up and suggested I play it, called Undone. And I was fascinated because I hadn't thought of that as a song that had anything to do with landscape. And I get it now. Sometimes you have to have other people kind of reflect what you do back to you to kind of see it. But we thought we'd kind of juxtapose that one with a maybe a little more literal one. Although this one, to me, is kind of a song about how when the landscape around you, the physical landscape, is actually blotted out, when you can't experience it directly because it's, say, snowing like a banshee and you're driving home on the highway in the middle of the night. How when you can't experience the landscape visually or anything like that, how it kind of draws you into a more inner landscape. And that being said, it's really just a song about sex. But landscape all its own is called Snowed In. Weatherman the road tonight if you know what's best. Mercury is falling, there's a storm rolling in from the Midwest. He called for 2 feet of snow, so I turned off my radio. I'd heard enough. Drive all night to be snowed in with a woman I love. Forty miles an hour from Connecticut to Maine, that's as fast as I could go. Hazard lights are flashing on the car spinning out. All by the side of the road, they don't know how to drive in the snow. Now you might think I'm crazy, but if you ever met my baby, you know why I'm out here in this stuff. Oh, I'm gonna drive all night, snowed in with the woman I love. Now when we wake up in the morning and they haven't cleared the streets, and everyone is digging out after the storm. Oh, and you call and sick and stand and climb back into bed. Well, I know a thing or two that's bound to keep us warm. Oh, yes, I do. I had a couple close calls, white knuckles on the wheel, and my nerves are frayed. She's gonna throw her arms around me and flash those baby blues, and all of my worries just gonna melt away. Oh, I'm pulling in the drive, I should be glad to be alive, but she's all I'm thinking of. Oh, oh, I drove all night. You know I drove all night. Oh, I drove all night to be snowed in with the woman I love.
Thank you very much. Barcarelli, Charles Ansbacher, Oni Minogue, Rand Blake. We'll take a short intermission, then do one more selection each, and then throw it open to questions here. So,
everybody so far has basically been speaking in favor of landscape and the natural world. But I thought maybe it was time to speak up for the other, well, one person in the world who I can think of who doesn't think that all of this is a good thing. No, this is just a silly little song that I wrote a while ago for, it's not really against the natural world, but it's against those moments when, say, you're having a really bad day, not a bad, like serious bad day, but just a pesky day, a day when it seems like the function of all the rhythms of the universe is to stub your toe all day long. And like maybe you're getting stuck in traffic on the expressway and traffic is moving so slowly that you can actually see them making progress on the big dig. I thought I was going to have to stop using that joke a couple years ago. And
admit it, a day like that, you get into a groove. You know, you have that extra cup of coffee when you know you shouldn't. You have some, you say, what I need is some sugar right now to improve my mood. And you go back out into traffic because you're having fun yelling at people, you know. And then at the end of a day like that, you run into one of these people who wants to tell you how wonderful the natural world is. Maybe take you on a walk through the Emerald Necklace and show you the wonders of God's creation. It's not that you disagree with them. You just want them to shut up. That may not seem like enough to inspire a song for you folks, but you probably don't have as much time on your hands as I do. John is courageous, but often unkind. William is merry, but lazy blind. Mary is easily frightened, but strong. Blaze in the spirit, the heart and the sun. If I live to 100, I never will see this natural perfection you are for me. If I live to 100, I never will see this natural perfection that you are for me. Yeah, 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 yeah. There it is. Folk music's first official wine along. Yeah, 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 yeah. Why did it take so long? Yeah, 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 yeah. Join me. It's therapeutic. It's cathartic. It's free. Yeah, 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 yeah. Think about something that annoyed you today and just... Yeah, 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 yeah. Think about who your president is. Yeah, 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 yeah. The little mouse is so cute when it's not in the house. The hawk looks so noble when not eating the mouse. The brown bear is gentle except when it's not. The gulls look so lovely when they're not on your dock. If I live to 100, I never will know this natural perfection you want us to show. If I live to 100, I never will see this natural perfection that you want to be. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Now, one of the ways I can turn a good day into a bad day, and I know this is a problem that's epidemic in the folk world, probably in the landscape world too, and that is that I overthink things. Notice I don't, it's not that I think too well about things, it's that I think too much about things. Long past the point where I should have stopped thinking and gotten on with my life. And I worry that sometimes I miss the point, you know, because I'm just overthinking things. Like, came across this quote from Rousseau, the great French philosopher. He said, the fear of death is much worse than death itself. And I'm thinking, now how did he know that? See, I might be missing the point. Henry David Thoreau, his most famous words of wisdom to us, the great Concord naturalist and philosopher, his most famous words of wisdom, he said, simplify, simplify. I'm thinking, so how come he said it twice? I might be missing the point. Here's the real reason I wrote this song. I just came up with this verse and I needed something to go before it and something to go after it so as I could call it a song. It's a good thing we don't know the language of birds. Hear only the melody, never the words. This branch is mine, it is mine, it is mine. Don't even think about those twigs. They are mine, they are mine. Bite my beak. Bite my beak. Got wings, use them. This judge is judgment, that priest is unclean. The sisters of mercy are strict in their mean. With these sweet scented hypocrites, high pious sins. It's God bless the sinner that knows what he is. If I live to 100, I never will know this natural perfection you want us to show. If I live to 100, I never will. Perfection that you want from me. Yeah, 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 yeah. Last chance. Yeah, 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 yeah. Think about your vice president. Yeah, 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 yeah. In short, thank you, culture buffs. Well, we're going to do one more piece from everybody. And then we'll open up to questions. I'd like to say, I regret to say, that Rand was not feeling well, Rand Blake, and he went home.
But he wanted to thank you all for a lovely time, and he had a great time. Sorry that he had to leave, but glad he was able to be here for part of it, and so are we. So be well, Randall. It's nothing serious. He just was a little tired and wanted to go home. So I guess we will go then to Onya Minogue for one last piece.
That's okay. I always judge the success of my own programs on the number of people I get to fall asleep. So anytime you don't feel like clapping, don't sweat it. The last thing I wanted to say about the sort of landscape in sort of the Celtic world was that all landscape was not equal. Some places were much more special than others. And I think that's fair to say that most of us probably feel that. I know one of my favorite places is Walden Pond, speaking of Thoreau, and lots of Cape Cod, and there's lots of places I stand on, and they make me feel different just the moment I stand there. And in Celtic culture, a lot of things that came from two different elements were considered very magical, like where two rivers met, perhaps, was considered a very magical place. And it was when two elements met, often, that they believed that these were gateways to the other world, and that's what gave them their specialness. So this tune I'm going to play for you, it's called King of the Fairies, to bring us down into the underworld, the land beneath the ground. Thank you.
I'd like to go on with a specific reference to landscape, if you will, or natural settings by a composer who wrote mostly in the 20th century, who's an Italian named Respighi. And he was a particularly effective orchestrator. And he wrote brilliantly for the instruments of the orchestra, and that is individually and collectively. And his Pines of Rome is obviously a depiction of various entryways into the city of Rome. He also had a love affair with the sounds of birds. And with his composition, which he entitled simply The Birds, which is made up of five different sections, movements. These are interesting in that they are not only his imitation or impressions of bird sounds, but he took music that was written by others in an earlier age, which did the same thing, and then dressed up those earlier pieces with his brilliant instrumentation. Jean-Philippe Rameau was one of the great French musicians who wrote much for the harpsichord and wrote for the Louis XIV and other... anyways, he's very, very much into the French tradition for the harpsichord. And he wrote a piece about the hen. And the hens are going around chirp, chirp, chirping and pecking. And this harpsichord piece imitated that. And Respighi found it interesting, and a hen is a bird, and so he included it. So this is about a minute's worth, and you'll hear this wonderful hen, and this musical hen portrayed in the orchestra, Respighi from the Birds. Thank you. I didn't realize that this was on there. This is actually the section, and that's fine, we can hear that again. This is actually a movement that is a dove, and it's a very different effect. But this is this dove is very, I don't know, lonesome or sad or remorseful, but it is a very peaceful and gorgeous long melody, the dove.
I was starting to think that hen is stoned. Don't tell me.
The dove. Contrast to that, now, with a little luck, we will hear the Rameau and the Respighi hen. I'm sorry.
That was hennier.
Well, what you heard was this descending minor third, pum pum, pim pum. Is actually the sound of a cuckoo, 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 and you'll hear that throughout. This is another bird, and there's instead of the accompaniment, you'll hear a celesta at times, a kind of a bell-like instrument. But you'll hear the cuckoo, cuckoo throughout this section. ¶¶ Is that it? Okay. Well, to hear the hen, it'll be necessary to come to the concert on September 5th.
Nicely done.
Sorry about that. Thank you.
Smooth. Mark Arelli.
Actually, to hear this last song, you have to come to my next show. I'm not.
Greenest lawn and
country club where we belong, and an SUV to get us there in style. But we don't keep track of what we've lost. We can't calculate the cost. There's no place left for a boy's imagination to run wild.
And now we'll throw it open if there are any people have any questions for any of us. Not all at once.
Wide open. We're throwing it wide open.
Yes. I think it's intriguing. I'm not sure what, you know, there is this, I think in American society it was much more celebrated in the 19th, 18th centuries, I think, than it has been more recently, that this was a very different society than any that had preceded it, in that it was not only the land, but the government was regarded as a common possession, as a commonwealth. And it's intriguing to me that the kind of the odyssey by which the Star Spangled Banner, which discusses none of that, became our favored national anthem, where Song America the Beautiful, which was, from my understanding, much more popular in the 19th century, which does very much focus on this being a land that sort of, as Woody Guthrie later said, that a land that was made for you and me, and that's what makes it separate. But I think that there is a feeling that's very strong in the American musical personality of seeing this country as being beautiful because it is God's gift to us, and it's ours. It is not, it doesn't belong to the privileged for us to work, that it's our common possession, it's our commonwealth. That's what I would think.
Well, I would say that in terms of the politics, that some of the most powerful, particularly of the folk songs, have been songs of protest or songs of outrage or sounds about singing about some form of oppression or organizing. And so I would say that the passions that come about through, a government that is perhaps not responsive or a society that is not responsive motivates song.
I just have one thing to add to that as a foreigner. You know, I was raised in a post-colonial nation, and I remember doing the Boston Duck Tour, and they told us that the, you know, the library in Boston was the first public library in America, if I'm not mistaken, and that the, you know, the Emerald Necklace was one of the first public parks. Please correct me if I'm incorrect here, but I just think it's a beautiful ideal to the original concept of American politics that you could, that the sort of the idea of books and nature and parks no longer just belong to the wealthy. And I remember at the time thinking how extraordinarily radical that thinking of the time was. And really all the parks of Europe were originally owned by the wealthy, and it was most likely by America's example that they turned around and had this publification of their park system. So I think while it's very easy to look on the negative, there was this beautiful positive ideal about, yes, as Scott said, it was our commonwealth.
This was very much Olmsted's vision too, by the way. He was part of a very progressive social movement in the 1800s as the Industrial Revolution created these new great cities, this new urban population, and brought a lot of people from rural landscapes into big cities. And there wasn't a lot of thought given to how these people were going to live their lives once they stopped work, where they were going to go at night, and where they could take their families. And there was a common effort started by, I don't know if Olmsted was involved, I'd be surprised if he wasn't, to buy up the riverfront property, for example, and to preserve it as a common possession, so that it wouldn't just belong to the wealthy, so that there would be landscape for everybody. The people, this is kind of off the subject, but the reason that the Storrow Drive is called Storrow Drive is because of the Storrow family who donated a lot of money to buy up that river property and helped organize a lot of the Boston elite to do the same. And it was the start, if you're familiar with the movie Songcatcher, about the people going down into the Appalachians to collect ancient ballads, the woman who did that and then sent them back to Boston, she sent them to Helen Osborne Storrow because she was very interested in folk literature and folk music, and said these seem to be very authentic variants of these ancient British and Scottish ballads. Maybe somebody should come down who knows what they're doing and collect them. And she was just in the process of bringing the British Isles preeminent folklorist Cecil Sharp over to this country to teach the urban poor how to do country dancing, and founded the English Country Dance and Song Society, for which he is remembered by literally dozens of people. The reason that trip is famous, and the English Country Dance and Song Society is still going strong, by the way. They're still doing wonderful English country dances all over New England. But he got those manuscripts, and he went back to England and prepared a field trip and came back and did the folk collecting that was inspired by Helen Osborne Storrow, that is to this day the seminal work of American folk songs and ballads collected in this country, and sort of the beginning of the modern folklore movement. And it all stems from this whole movement of the rich in this country feeling that they had a kind of a special responsibility to make sure that this country didn't end up looking like Europe with all its privatized parks. I don't know if that gives you any suggestions for the next election, but it does me. Yes.
I've been reading Walden, and I noticed you mentioned... Oh, great, a microphone. Great. I've been reading Walden recently, and I noticed you mentioned it earlier. And then yesterday, I watched some of the Live Earth concert, and I was really struck by the contrast between one individual person living next to Walden Pond in a little house that he built by himself, and 2 billion people participating in a global musical event. And the question that I have really is, in this world that we're living in today, where we're all connected with people all over the world, What is the role, or is there a way in which music can really help to bring all of the people of the world together in a way that is harmonious with our natural environment?
I don't know if music makes a difference or not. Globally, I think, speaking just for myself, this is something I've wrestled with a lot, just in singing about things that may be perceived as political, and landscape being among those things, like in the last song, that could be construed as anti-development. I think for me, it's just stuff that I want to sing about because I love it. It's not politics. It's not landscape. They're all just love songs, And just whether they're love songs for my wife or for my forest that I love in a different way for different reasons, or my country, I think of them all as love songs, and I think one should never underestimate the power of love, and we can use all of it that we can get. And for me, if I'm just kind of radiating that, that's my little contribution. Does it matter all alone? It does to me, but probably not alone in the context of the scale of the world. But I think, again, for me, there are different styles of leadership, and I'm a lead by example kind of person, I think. In fact, I don't really much like to lead at all. I just like to kind of do things the way that seems to be right to me, and if other people want to follow or copy, that's great. So I think for me, it's just putting out that kind of positive energy into the world, and if it has some kind of global or widespread impact, great. If it makes me feel better so that I don't despair and check out or just succumb to greed or depression or any number of things that kind of haunt the modern world, that's almost enough. But I think it is a kind of magnification at different levels of scale, from the individual all the way up to the global level. And we all share that responsibility. It sounds corny, you've heard it before, but everyone can't do it until each of us individually is doing it. It's a very long-winded answer to say I don't know, but I'm not sure.
I think because music, like landscape, is a very emotional experience, that one of the great powers, I think, of folk music is of a folk song is that you begin to realize that tradition is really just another word for community, and that it's this shared experience across centuries and millennia. The song, like the Silky song that Onya sang, probably 1,000 years old. It's old enough that it's found indigenously in Ireland, Scotland, and all throughout the British Isles. So it predates even the things that divided them. And to be able to listen to her sing it here in Brookline and to find yourself smelling the ocean because of the rolling of that melody is to feel an emotional community with people from completely different cultures and societies and 1,000 years back. And I think when you listen to Beethoven, and it's not just the landscape that he makes you see, but it's so deeply felt. And the mood of that walk that he took so long ago is so palpable that we realize when a piece of music can make us all feel the same thing, that we really are neighbors, and we really do live in the same big house.
That's a good point too about the emotional impact of music. it being nonlinear. It's not just like what's the how do you quantify the feeling from hearing a song once? You know, it's a nonlinear thing. To my mind, especially compared to some of the other people up here, I'm not doing that much. I'm just banging out a few chords and singing a few things that I made up that rhymed. But in other people, you know, might feel that experience in a nonlinear fashion, and you know, far beyond just the simple act of what I'm doing. I think that's what you were talking about with, you know, songs kind of happening across cultures and across geographical spans. You know, these are stories, and there's something in these songs that resonate very deeply, kind of on orders of magnitude more than you might think from just a melody and some words put together, you know? So in that case, I'd like to change my answer. I do think music can change the world because of the nonlinear emotional response that we have to music, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Maybe for the sake of time and things, maybe we could ask Mark to help us out in closing this evening with a song.
I did want, if I could, just real quickly, I wanted to ask Charles, when you were doing the Beethoven selections, and the landscaping was so vivid, and after you described it, it was so obvious that this is where what he was doing, and these are what the sounds were, and everything. When he wrote the Pastorale, did he convey that information to people, or did he leave it up to you to figure it out?
No, it is. He was fairly specific in the movements that the movements have titles that say that. Mm. And the fourth movement is entitled The Thunderstorm, and another, as I mentioned, is By the Brook, and the dance of peasant people. He, in the score, writes in which is the quail and which is the cuckoo, you couldn't figure that out, and which is the, he was quite literal with it, and other composers have been that way as well. They're not always that way, but in this instance, he was very clear.
He wasn't being aloof and leaving it up to us. Good for him.
Can you do that song?
Sure. This song, by the way, gets back to the first question that was asked. It was written in an angry tantrum mood in response to hearing the song God Bless America by Irving Berlin. And Woody Guthrie was furious at the concept that we were exalting this country because for some reason God had blessed it for us. And he thought that kind of missed the point of some of the things we were saying earlier about what made this country special, because who doesn't believe that God blessed their country for them? And so he wrote this very angry song that this land's not God's land. This land is my land. This land's not God's land. This land is your land. And in a calmer mood, he turned it into a song that many people regard as our national anthem. Mark's going to sing it. Please join us.
Do you want to take a verse? Or
sure.
Should we alternate
Steve
verses?
Steve on in here. Would you want to do it? Is there a hen in here? Let's see. You owe us a hen.
This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. This land was made for you and me, as I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me an endless skyway, and I saw below me
a golden valley. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water, this land was made for you and me. My land, from California to New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Oh, this land was made for you and me.
This is a verse that doesn't get into the Boston Pops version real, but it was, from everything I've heard, it was Woody's favorite. As I was walking, I saw a sign there, and that sign said, no trespassing. But on the other side, it didn't say nothing. Now that side was made for you and me.
This land is your land, this land is my land. From California to New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
There's also a verse that kind of speaks to your question before about landscape and music and politics and power and whatnot. And as I've heard Arlo Guthrie describe it, it's not a verse that they necessarily teach the kids in grammar school when they teach them this song. I know I didn't learn it. And anyway, that last verse might have been Woody's favorite verse, but this one's mine.
In the squares of the city, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief office, I see my people. And some are grumbling, and some are wondering if this land's still made for you and me. As this land is your land, this land is my land. From California to New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Oh, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. Oh, this land was made for you and me.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.